Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here. We have a number of items that are scheduled on the agenda today, but I want to just start off with what's not going to be moving today. Senate Bill 40, we're waiting for an amendment. That means we need amendments plus paperwork, so that will not be happening today. What we're going to do is set that one over. Mike, do you want to set that for Tuesday of next week?
Tuesday of next week.
All right, so Senate Bill 40, for those who are here, is going to be scheduled for next Tuesday, which is the 16th, if I'm not mistaken. And my understanding at this point, we've already had a public hearing, so all we really need to do is the work session. So if we can schedule that for work session, unless, you know, technically we have to repost it as it is. I don't think we do because we've got 48 hours notice. Then it should be work session for April 16th. Dropping down to the bills that we had public hearing last Friday on with the gun safety regulations, Senate Bill 347, Senate Bill 699, Senate Bill 700, and Senate Bill 796. Again, we're waiting on most of those for additional amendments. Based on the testimony we heard, members have discussed and want to have additional amendments, so we're waiting for them to come in. We also will need to have the paperwork that has to go with those amendments. What I'm going to do for those, based on our timing at this point, I am going to set them for work session next Monday. That's April 15th. No guarantee we're going to be able to have them there because I just won't know if we'll have all the amendments back. Hopefully we'll have the amendments and we'll have the fiscal and the revenue to take those bills up then. If not, then we'll be into a rollover state, which next week, anything that's set for next week that isn't done, we'll just be rolling them over day to day based on just paperwork and the logistics of moving them forward. We also had scheduled for work session today, Senate Bill 780. We are not ready for that. We're waiting for, I believe it's just the paperwork. I'm not sure it's an amendment. It's an amendment, so we got to get the amendment. Then the amendment has to go down and have all the paperwork, just like I said, on the other bills. So that one is also going to be, I'm going to move that to bills date since it's bills. So that's going to be set for Wednesday, the 17th. All right. And we'll go through this one more time at the end of the meeting. But for those that are here for those bills, we're not moving them today. That's the plan for those. So sorry for the inconvenience for those who are coming, but we're at that stage where we have to make certain we get everything done in line with the time frame that we have. So that leaves us with SJR 34. We'll take that up as a public hearing at, later. We will... Senate Bill 622, we are going to take testimony on that. We are waiting for paperwork on it, so it more than likely would not be able to do a work session, but we will take the public testimony on it. And 281, we are waiting for the fiscal. While we're here, if it comes in, we can work that bill. If not, then we'll need to carry that over, and I believe that will take care of the agenda that we have for today. So with that, let me go ahead and start with 622. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 622. Bill?
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 622, and you have the desk, two amendments in front of you. Both the bill and the amendments come from the Law Commission, and the juvenile court proceeding defines record of the case as including the summons, petitions, pleadings, motions, exhibits, transcripts, and affidavits, local citizens board, review board finding, and other matters as it relates to records in juvenile cases.
All right. Okay, so we have, it looks like, five individuals at this point who have positioned themselves for giving testimony. Lane, why don't you and Wendy please come up and give us the intro and opening, and then I have, we'll bring up the other two or three. And while you're getting set, Charlie Hinkle. Charlie, I just want to know, it looks like you've signed up regarding the amendment. Did you want to just testify on the amendment or on the bill itself as well?
I have one comment on the bill.
Okay, thank you. All right, Lane, why don't you get started?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lane Shatterly, I'm here today as chair of the Oregon Law Commission. We bring you Senate Bill 622 with the -2 amendments that are before you. This bill comes to you in much the same context and with much the same background as the adoption bill that you heard last week. That is, it was requested by the Oregon Judicial Department that the Law Commission take up the issue, in this case not of access to adoption records, but access to juvenile court records. And it came up the same way that the adoption bill came up. The judicial department, doing their work on e-court, is going through this process and of determining what records are going to be available to whom and how. Just as in the adoption case, it came to the department's attention that there really is the same kind of lack of clarity in the law currently as to who has access to juvenile records, juvenile court records. So the Law Commission was asked and agreed to take that project up, just as it did the adoption records. We assembled a work group of experts in the area of juvenile law. That work group made a recommendation to the commission. It addresses access, and Wendy will walk you through the details of it, but it addresses access to records parties, by the child, parents, by CASA volunteers, and various other people who are involved in juvenile court proceedings. Let me give you just a little procedural background on what's occurred here, because it will give you context for testimony you'll hear later after Wendy and I are done. The work group dealt with all those issues that I just discussed, those access to by those individuals to the records and who has the right to copy records and under what circumstances. And all that was fairly a consensus product. Where we came to some lack of consensus in the getting to the final product was the issue of persons other than those specifically mentioned in the bill, whether the court would have authority to grant discretion to someone other than a party, someone other than the child, other than parents, other than the department, some other interested party, possibly the press, possibly a concerned other public member. The work group originally took the position, I think in the original draft, that the court would have discretion to grant access under limited circumstances. The work group then changed that recommendation to remove discretion from the court's authority to grant access to these additional other parties, meaning that essentially the records would be closed to anyone other than the individual specifically mentioned in the bill. That recommendation came before the Law Commission, and the Law Commission's job in reviewing a recommendation that comes from a work group is to evaluate the recommendation in the context of other considerations and then make a final recommendation to the legislature. And in doing its work, the Law Commission actually changed the work group's final recommendation in this case to go back to the draft that you have in the dash-2s that, among other things, give the court's discretion, judicial discretion, to allow access to others that are not specifically named in the bill. The commission did this believing that that is consistent with current law and practice in most counties around the state, that it is reasonable to recognize that we can't, in drafting the statute, anticipate every circumstance where some person might have a reasonable basis to request access to a juvenile court record. So thought best that rather than create this rule that no one else would have access and the judges would not have discretion, that we would give the judges discretion, again, believing that carries forward current practice. At the same time, before the Law Commission, the argument was made to us by Mr. Hinkle, who you will hear, that the Oregon Constitution actually compels open access to juvenile court records, so that the bill should reflect that by authorizing access to these juvenile court records by persons other than those who are listed in the bill. So faced with the choice of basically no discretion to allow access to sort of the other extreme of pretty much open access to juvenile court records, the Law Commission took what we consider to be the middle ground, which we think again carries forward existing law and policy that has been part of the juvenile law for a long time, to allow the judges to have access, discretion to allow access to juvenile court records to other parties. We think that to go either to take away that discretion completely from the judges or to open up the juvenile court records to non-parties, non-parents, and others who are not party to the proceeding, both of those would be significant changes in legislative policy that we weren't prepared to recommend. Mr. Henkel believes that his argument is actually compelled by the Constitution. I think there's some disagreement about that. Certainly there was among the Law Commission. There is a mandamus action in front of the Supreme Court that may get a ruling on that, but for now we were not ready to go that far as a matter of stating legislative policy. So with that as background, I hope that sets in context some of the comments you'll hear today. There's really three options for you. I mean, we're recommending, the Law Commission is recommending, the avenue that we think hews to the middle, which is to give judges discretion. But you'll hear from the advocates of either end of the spectrum as well this morning. But the strong recommendation of the commission was the what you see in the Dash 2 amendments.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission. Our written testimony is an explanatory report of Senate Bill 622, and it's noted with the Dash 2 amendments. The work group wasn't finished when the filing deadlines hit, so the filed bill was not our completed product. The Dash 2 amendments do reflect that completion with, as Mr. Shetterly explained, some amendments that the commission itself made, and those are also reflected in the Dash 2 amendments. I know, Mr. Chair, that you have a list of signups. There in the room also are members from the Oregon Judicial Department, OPDS, and the Department of Justice, should you have questions from those members. The report explains who participated on this work group, and we did have members from the Defense Bar, the Department of Justice, DHS, OPDS, the courts, et cetera. It was a large work group. Juvenile court records are regulated in ORS Chapter 419A, and so that means that it applies to both dependency and delinquency records, and that's why the bill is rather lengthy and complicated, because there are different rules for dependency and delinquency records, so keep that in mind. Oregon, like most states, treat juvenile records differently. They're generally confidential. They are withheld from the public, and this bill doesn't change that. We've kept in that language that it says that juvenile records are to be withheld from the public. ORS 7.230, an existing law, says that the courts are to keep those records separate. And with e-court, they still will be kept separate, but it'll be an electronic universe, and they have a special confidentiality type tag in the electronic universe. So we're maintaining that. But what the court actually keeps has been confusing. They're generally, practitioners refer to it as the record of the case in juvenile cases and the social file. Although you'll find the word social file nowhere in the ORS. That's just what people have called it. So with this bill, we'll finally label that other file, which is, but the bill, the language we chose was supplemental confidential file. These are materials that are not officially in the court record that will be in the record on appeal. Rather, they're materials that generally automatically come to the court. They're reports, they're pieces of history and prognosis, generally medical or psychological information, or could be reports from schools or service providers. It's those materials that are not officially provided as exhibits and such. So but the court still, in practice, has maintained that record. So we keep those and we define those terms. Going through the bill, I'll start with Section 1. We do define person, and instead of just covering individuals, which is confusing, we do make sure that we cover state agencies and public bodies. There's a new term, prospective appellate attorney. We added this term because OPDS really needs it. It's not unlike when you're represented and you're paying for it, you know who your attorney is, and you can obviously provide access to that attorney. OPDS has contracts, and they need to figure out if they have a conflict of interest or not, and whether there's even an appealable case. And so we need to pick up this group of attorneys that are really prospective, to have some access to the court file before they actually represent the juvenile. As I said, we've defined record of the case now. We've defined supplemental confidential file. And we've used most of the words of how record of the case has been defined in statute, but we have added to the language. 418A255 had listed out some of the documents that are in this record of the case, but we've specifically added answers, affidavits, and judgments. And we've also added citizen review board findings and guardianship report summaries. This has generally been the practice, but it's been unclear in the law what things need to be in the official record of the case. Just a note on guardianship report summaries. This is a new requirement. Right now, you just submit a guardianship report, and it's been unclear whether that goes in the social file or whether that goes in the record of the case file. With this bill, a summary basically stating that a report was done, the date, who did it, would go in the record of the case, but the report itself would go in the supplemental confidential file, the social file, unless it was offered as an exhibit or something. That's been an inconsistent practice, and it is, the work group felt it was particularly sensitive information that shouldn't generally go into the record of the case. The bill makes it clear that transcripts are to be part of the record of the case, and so are exhibits, whether they're offered and received or whether they're just offered. And finally, supporting documents, attachments to motions and things would become part of the record of the case. Supplemental confidential file is defined in Section 1, and basically that's the holding place, as I said, for the materials that don't qualify as part of the record of the case. And the bill loosely defines that, and we're relying on the history and prognosis phrasing, continuing that terminology that case law has so developed. Finally, both record of the case and the supplemental confidential file in Section 1, it provides that those records that are created electronically are part of those records. As Commissioner Shetterly explained, eCourt was part of the reason for this project, and the bill does make it clear that this law would apply to both paper records and electronic records. Moving on to Section 2 of the bill, this is amending 419A.253. This is really just cleanup in juvenile court. There's a process for when a party has not made something a part of the record and the judge is intending to rely on it, the judge on their own can either mark it as an exhibit and receive it or judicially notice information. That's the existing statute, but it's been applied differently, and it's caused confusion. So basically, we're just tightening it up and making it clear to provide better guidance to parties and judges how to do that procedure. There's not an easy route to go. There really are only four doors in juvenile court as well to get something into evidence, and it needs to be done properly to judicially notice, stipulate, take it as evidence or as testimony, and so it just cleans up that provision. It also would make information that is received in this statute part of the record of the case. Section 3 is the main records statute, and it's just being amended. Again, it provides that there's no public access. That language is maintained, but it does now specify that the court is to keep the record of the case and the court is to keep the supplemental confidential file. For a long time, it's been unclear who maintains the supplemental confidential file, the social file, and so this bill will finally make it clear that there is one such file, and it's the court that keeps that file. Then you'll see that the bulk of the report, starting at page 9, lists who gets this. Now that we've defined what's in the record of the case and what's in the supplemental confidential file or the social file, it lists who has inspection rights and who has copyrights. And the report just puts out who is added specifically. And I just want to go through it quickly, basically to make a record, to make it clear. We are intending to make it clear that judges will always have access to inspect and copy. So you'll see that addition. Existing law only had judges at one spot and not for both files, and so we're just clarifying that. Guardian ad litems had been missing totally. Guardian ad litems, as you may know, they're not a party, but they are representative of the parent. And the work group felt it was very important that whatever rights the parent has, the guardian ad litem should have those same rights in order to effectively represent. So guardian ad litems are given the same access rights and copyrights that the parents have. So you'll see that. And then for service providers have been provided access to the social file, but they had not been provided access to the record of the case, the more mundane court records and things, and they are getting those copies on a redisclosure anyway, and so the work group added those in. And then that term, prospective appellate attorney, wherever attorney was used, the attorneys have access to the records, a prospective attorney was added so that the OPDS workings actually make sense in the statute. And then lastly, for each spot, the inspection of the record of the case, the copies of the record of the case, the inspection of the supplemental confidential file, and the copies of the supplemental confidential file, we've added any other person allowed by the courts to make it clear the court has discretion for each of these access and copy areas to provide any other person. As Commissioner Shetterly explained, there is ongoing litigation on this issue, but the commission felt that it was not appropriate to leave it ambiguous on this point. So we do provide discretion with this any other person that's provided four times in the bill. CASAs are added in a couple of places. CASAs were missing from access to the record of the case for depending on how you read the statute, because there's a really long phrase, but CASAs are added, and we believe that under existing law and the CASA statutes that CASAs do have access to records, and so we're making that consistent. We did have an issue with parents' access, and the work group was not able to come to consensus on that, of changing it. There was a strong contingent that would have liked to have changed access by parents in dependency cases, but instead we were not able to reach a consensus, so we're leaving that status quo. Existing law provides the access rules in the respective dependency and delinquency chapters, and we're leaving that provision alone. Let me see. I guess the remaining sections of the bill from section, I should spend some time on section 5. Section 4 is on transcripts, and we're just clarifying the appellate court transcript issues, making those the same, and then we're using the same list of people for access to the transcript that would have access to the record of the case. But in section 5, this is a brand new provision. Existing law does not provide a specific provision for the Oregon Youth Authority or the juvenile departments for records that they have that are related to a juvenile's history and prognosis, this social file type material. There's no standalone provision for the Youth Authority or the juvenile departments. Instead, they have relied on 419A.255, the main juvenile records piece that many thought focused only on juvenile courts or should be focused on juvenile courts. But there's attorney general opinions and case law and such that the juvenile departments and the Oregon Youth Authority have relied on to protect history and prognosis records. So instead of continuing that confusion, the same language is now put in Section 5 to make it clear that records regarding history and prognosis of a juvenile that the Oregon Youth Authority or the juvenile department have those same protections. So that's in Section 5. Existing Section 5 has been taken out, and we put that into Section 3 that had mainly dealt with the state actors. But this provision has been worked out sort of at the last minute, candidly, with Oregon Youth Authority and the juvenile department to make sure that they have their own section and that it meets with their needs. Section 6 is that tweak on the guardianship summary, and Section 7 through 10 are really just cleanup and conforming amendments, except for the audio and video recordings in Section 8. That was just an omission. It's a part of the Court of Appeals process that's missing, that the Court of Appeals has oral arguments, and there's no provision addressing who has access to that. So basically, they would be treated the same as those at the trial court with a reference to the 419A provision. Finally, in Section 11, we have the operative dates. This bill would apply to proceedings commenced on or after the effective date, and there aren't any retroactive provisions to it. At the conclusion of the report really does summarize what the bill does. Again, it's about making clear what the court is to have in its records and who is to have access to those records. It's separating the record of the case from the supplemental confidential file or the social file. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you, Wendy, very much for the detailed overview to make certain we have the record. Is there any questions, Senator Close? Yes, you bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wendy, I notice on page 14, you're including school superintendents.
She's looking for the dash twos.
And their designees. I'm just wondering what the work group, where they were going on that, since they're not part of the court system.
Chair Prusansky, Senator Close, are you talking about page 14 of the dash two or 14 of the report?
Dash twos.
Dash twos, looks like on line 25.
Yep.
The school superintendents and their designees?
Right. Why they would need access to the, these are the court records, right?
Chair Prusansky, Senator Close, this actually came about, I think, a session or two ago. Schools provide services, of course, to juveniles, and some of these juveniles are now going back to the schools, and they need to know the treatment services, this sort of the psychological evaluations and those medical reports to make sure that they're providing the right safety in the schools.
Not only for the juvenile, but for the other students.
Correct.
And their staff.
Correct. Any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Coming forward. So we have three other people that are scheduled at this point, so I'm going to ask for all of them to come forward. Tim Lowen, Charlie Hinkle, and then Mara Roach. And what I'd like to do is, Tim, I'd like for you to go first. And then I think, Mara, you're set up. Well, I'm going to say Charlie and then Mara.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, my name is Tim Lowen. I'm the Juvenile Department Director for Yamhill County. I'm also here representing the Juvenile Department Directors Association. We are in support of Senate Bill 622. It happens to be that in our county, and our county court system started the e-court pilot. And as you might guess, any kind of pilot stumbles a little bit, but somehow we've made it through. And this is what believed to be a very good system where the court has electronic files and can make that available to the parties that necessarily need these documents. So this has become an important thing not only in our county, but as it's rolled out through other counties in the state, important for the judicial system to clearly identify what records are to be submitted to what parties and what people involved in that system. A little history on some of this, the statutes around juvenile and juvenile records. Probably about three decades ago, the juvenile departments and the juvenile court judges were part of the same system. The juvenile court judges oversaw the juvenile departments. The records, in terms of our statutory protection of those records, are identified primarily in 419A255. And sub 1 currently protects, at least as it's been seen, is to protect those court records very specifically as to who has access and how those are distributed. Sub 2 also could be handled by the court system, but it's been used by other departments. Then CSD, with the creation of OIA in 95, they began to use the sub 2 as a protection as well. Also, juvenile departments continue to use this after a separation from the juvenile judges and the juvenile departments. In the mid-90s, DHS had some additional requirements for their dependency cases by federal rule. They adopted some additional statutory protections under what we see under Chapter 409. So as the e-court moves forward now, and there's a strong need to clarify those things, it became apparent that there's a further separation of this statute that we've relied upon for many years. Through the course of the work group's efforts, we've created a separate section to help continue to protect the records of OIA, of the juvenile departments, and others, the other agencies in the provision of their efforts in working with juveniles. I want to make sure that folks are understanding that our systems are very different than the adult system. You know, much like we have sentencing, or excuse me, convictions in adult world, we have adjudications in the juvenile world. Much like we have sentences, we have, in the adult world, we have dispositions in the juvenile world. There's a lot of things that are changed, and we have a system set up, and actually in Oregon, we believe a really strong system to protect the juveniles in that system. Juveniles make mistakes along the way. We see that. We have evidence-based programming and research that indicates that a lot of the brain development of most kids doesn't really mature till the mid-20s. And if I looked at my own children, I would say that might go a little bit longer. However, it is a system that they make changes, and our system is built on rehabilitation, and it's built on the idea that kids make mistakes and that we have to protect them in the course of what they do. And we provide much greater a level of rehabilitation, restorative services than the adult world does. And that's for a purpose. It's because we believe it's important with our children and our juveniles to turn them around and to rehabilitate them and make them productive members as they turn into adults in society. I want to give an example of what could happen if things are opened up into to everybody gaining access. You have a 12-year-old who is lights a fire in a middle school trash bin of a bathroom. That 12-year-old might be charged with arson one. It's a very serious felony because of the endangerment of other youth in that school and other teachers. If that's opened up, potentially anybody can gain access to any of the, not only, you know, potential court records, but potential exhibits that come to pass or something as are presented in that court action. Media currently, and everybody else, has open access to courtrooms. So they can come in and hear the evidence, but they don't have access to the records. The important thing, I think, here is that those records can stick with a youth in school, in their community, with the parents, as they go through this process that makes it very difficult for them to maintain their ongoing relationship in the community and to maintain that youth's success in a school district or in their community. You know, and that happens to a lot of parents as we go through our systems anyway. We try to minimize that. But I want you to imagine that that 12-year-old might be your nephew, your niece, your son or daughter, and potentially the media or somebody could take advantage of that, or somebody else, any public member could take that information and run with that. So it's very important, we believe, to protect the confidentiality of this of the records in the system. We believe 622 continues to do that, and we think it's a good thing. We ask your support of it.
Thank you, Tim. Mm-hmm. Charlie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charles Hinkle. I'm a lawyer in Portland, and I've been practicing law in the area of open courts and access to government proceedings for quite a long time. The one comment, Mr. Chair, that I'd like to address to the dash two amendments of the bill as submitted to you, which I think is a great bill. These statutes need clarification, and the commission has done a very good job in doing so. But since it is a good thing, and since it does bring needed clarification, my question would be on the very last section, on the last page. Why apply it only to cases commencing after the effective date of the statute? Why not apply it to pending cases? Because any, you know, a juvenile, a child, an infant, a two-day-old infant goes into the system today in a dependency case, he or she may be in the system for the next 18 years. And so that means all of these clarifying amendments would not apply to him or her or to all the hundreds of other juveniles who are in the system right now. So I think the committee ought to consider making it applicable to pending cases. That really wasn't the purpose for my coming today, though, Mr. Chair. Can I, may I turn now to my proposal?
You may.
Thank you. There seems to be some misunderstanding about what my proposal is. Neither before the Oregon Law Commission nor before this committee have I proposed any change in the law respecting access to court records. My only proposed amendment, And the subject of the litigation, too, I might add, is solely access to court orders and judgments, not to the record. So the comments that the previous speaker made with respect to access to records is irrelevant to my position. My position is this. The Oregon Constitution prohibits secret courts. And the very definition of a secret court is one that can issue secret orders and secret judgments that dispose of the rights and responsibilities of the people who come before it. The very definition of a secret court is one where the public has no access to what the court does. The public can never find out what the court has done with respect to these matters. So it's not, again, not a question of access to records. It's an access to the actual written court order or court judgment which disposes of these matters. The irony of the present situation is, as the previous speaker just said, the public does have access to the hearings. Whether it's a dependency hearing or a delinquency hearing, the public has an absolute right to attend that court hearing, but it has no right to find out what the court did with respect to that hearing at the end of it. And that seems to me to be run flatly in the face of the prohibition on secret courts. We know from the Oregon Supreme Court decisions, and as the previous speakers have said, the prohibition on secret courts applies to all courts in Oregon. It applies specifically, the court has said, to juvenile court proceedings. But the Constitution makes no distinction between different kinds of courts. Now, Oregon voters don't go to the polls and elect juvenile court judges. They elect circuit court judges. And circuit court judges on day one may be hearing a juvenile case. On day two, they may be hearing a death penalty case. On day three, they may be hearing a contract dispute or an insurance dispute. No court in Oregon can be secret. And this is where the proponents of secrecy in Senate Bill 622 and elsewhere have never come up with a satisfactory answer. If the legislature has the power to say to the courts, you can keep your juvenile court decisions secret, then there's nothing in the Constitution to prevent you from saying, you can keep your death penalty decisions secret. You can keep your tobacco litigation decision secret. You can keep any decision secret because the Constitution applies equally to all courts. And it makes no distinction, and the proponents of secrecy have never suggested any plausible reason why or any constitutional reason why the legislature or anyone else should be able to draw that distinction. Does it make a difference? I submitted written testimony to the committee in which I discussed the Adriana Cram case, a case in which a juvenile court, on the advice and recommendation and at the request of DHS, sent a little girl, a four-year-old girl, to her relatives in Mexico, where she was murdered 4 or 5 months after she got there, murdered by her aunt, her paternal aunt in Mexico. This is an ancient history. This happened, I think it was in 2006 or 7. The Oregonian learned about the incident, asked for a copy of the court order by which she was sent down there. It published a couple of articles on it. This legislature, DHS, immediately responded by changing its procedures, and this legislature immediately responded by adopting the statute that I have quoted in my memorandum. Secrecy in court systems is bad for democracy. It is bad for public policy. But whatever the policy reasons are, the Constitution has already said to us, no court shall be secret. So I'm not here to ask that all court records be open. I have never asked for that. The pending litigation has nothing to do with that. The proposed amendment that is attached at the end of my written testimony says, this is my proposed amendment, every person has a right to inspect any order or judgment of a court that changes the custody of a child, ward, youth, or youth offender. The second request that I'm making is that the committee change the question of public access to an audio recording or transcript of a hearing. Again, I'm not asking for anything new here because the hearing is already open to the public. You and I or any other member of the public can go to every juvenile court hearing, whether it's a delinquency case or a dependency case, and we can hear all the evidence. But what we can't do then is get a transcript of that hearing later. And the only effect of that is to say, well, your report of it then, or your discussion of it, or your news article about it, whatever case may be, is going to be based on faulty memory, and rather than the actual wording. And the chicken has come home to roost in my own experience, because in these pending Supreme Court cases now, I am unable to get a copy of the transcript of the last court hearing before Judge McKnight in Multnomah County Circuit Court. I can't even tell the Oregon Supreme Court what I said or what the judge said other than what I remember. You know, and I'm speaking at the time and I'm not taking notes. I can't get an audio recording. I can't get a transcript of it. And that just seems to me to be crazy. If you have a right to attend the hearing, you ought to be able to have the right to obtain a transcript of it. So two things I'm asking the committee to consider. Make court orders and judgments available to the public, because it makes no sense to say the public can attend a hearing, but then it has no right to find out what the judge does. If you can do it in juvenile court, then by golly, you can do it in criminal court and you can do it in civil court. The Constitution makes no distinction. So I ask the committee to make orders and judgments available to the public, and I ask you to make transcripts or audio recordings of the hearings available to the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Maura?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Maura Roach and I'm here today representing Youth Rights and Justice. As you know, Youth Rights and Justice is a 35-year-old not-for-profit law firm representing parents, youth, and children in the juvenile court system. SB 622 deals with an extremely important and complicated issue, the privacy of records of some of the most vulnerable and troubled families in the state of Oregon. The Oregon Law Commission diligently tackled this issue and made a great deal of headway on it. However, the bill, including the most recent amendments presented to you, is not complete. It has not had the benefit of the thorough study and diverse input that other Oregon Law Commission bills typically receive. As you've heard, late in the process, the Oregonian, a litigant in several Oregon Supreme Court cases involving the language and construction of juvenile code records statutes, intervened in the commission deliberations proposing amendments to the bill. While the commission is a public body and the actions of the Oregonian are permissible, its intervention resulted in members of the OLC and of the work group tackling the juvenile records issue having to recuse themselves from the process. And this was both members of the Judiciary Justice Department and Juvenile Defense Bar. Youth Rights and Justice Attorney Julie McFarland is an Oregon Law Commission member, and she in fact chaired the juvenile work group, and she recused herself from the process at that point because YRJ represents a party pending in the litigation. Thus, the bill before you does not represent, as OLC bills usually do, the best and most thorough thinking of the legal experts on all sides of the issue. Normally, we feel extremely comfortable with bills introduced by the OLC as representing a broad consensus, and SB 622 is unfortunately an exception. The decision of this magnitude should be deferred until this important work can be thoroughly completed. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Questions? I've got questions. Let me start off, Maura, since you're the last one. So delaying this, meaning waiting until what the litigation has done, so those individuals who have recused themselves can then participate? I just need some guidance on that.
Yeah. I think my recollection of discussion, and I think Bill's been in some of those meetings too, and maybe was in some that I wasn't in as well, that perhaps till the short session would be the delay.
I understand the length of the delay. That's not my point. The question is, while we wait for, we're waiting for what? I mean,
I'm going to have to get back to my client on that. I apologize, but because everybody working on this is recused, this was fairly late that they were sticking me into this hearing, and I'll have to check back with them to let you know.
Right, so for clarification,
yes.
So we're speaking on the same terms. What I need to know and what the committee will want to know is the purpose for delaying. Is it to allow those individuals, well, first I think it would be to allow the litigation to move forward and be resolved and get whatever is going to happen to that, to the point that those commissioners who were active, who recused themselves, can come back? Or is there something else beyond that for their participation?
I will find out.
Okay, thank you. And Charlie, two things, I guess, as you articulated yourself well, but I think this is important to put on the record. My understanding is, and I have not gone to a juvenile hearing, have not ever done juvenile work, is that anyone in the public can, in fact, go to the hearing itself. At the point where a court, the judge makes the determination of what's going to be in the court order / judgment, is that not done in open court? And that's, and basically the general public are removed from the room before they make their pronouncement? Can you walk us through that, please?
Well, I'm sure that varies from case to case, Mr. Chairman, but many trial judges, no matter what kind of hearing they're in, will take it under advisement and issue a written statement later. And this simply encourages that. I mean, I suspect, I have not attended these sorts of hearings, and so I can't give you firsthand response, but I suspect that given the great penchant for secrecy, which I would say varies from county to county, but some circuit judges who really are proponents of secrecy would deliberately do that, would not make a decision at the end of a hearing, but would say, I'll issue a written opinion because I don't have to make that public.
And that's, I guess that's the next part, which you just trailed off to, is that it's your understanding that if the court takes it under advisement and then issues a written opinion instead of ruling from the bench, that those are then orders that are kept confidential and are not released, are known to the general public.
Mr. Chair, that is exactly the case, and that's exactly what the litigation is about.
Then the other question I have, and I don't know if you can articulate on this and give us any focus, what the rule is in other states as it pertains to juvenile proceedings as to making available the court orders or judgments to the general public.
That varies considerably from state to state as well.
Okay,
Mr. Chair. I would like to add one point of clarification. I appeared before the Oregon Law Commission not as a representative of the Oregonian, but on my own behalf, and that's what I'm doing here today. I'm not speaking for the Oregonian.
I appreciate that. No, thank you for the disclaimer. Okay, anyone else have any questions based on those questions or comments? Thank you very much. And Bill, I know you've spoken with someone. Do we need to bring anyone else?
Members of the committee, I just spoke to Nancy Kozin, I was at the Defense Commission, about this issue. And she tells me that it...
Why don't we do this? Nancy, I'm going to put you on the spot. If y'all would move back, please. Nancy, I'd like for you to come up instead of having it secondhand since you're here.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Mr. Taylor just asked me what my experience was in terms of courts issuing judgments.
I need you to put your name on the record.
Thank you. For the record, Nancy Kozine. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. And I should clarify, I'm probably not testifying in that capacity. Prior to joining OPDS, I worked with the courts as criminal law staff counsel, as a deputy trial court administrator, and before that, I practiced criminal and juvenile law. So, in my experience, Mr. Taylor asked me what my experience was with courts pronouncing judgment, and in my experience, it does vary from court to court, that it's common in delinquency proceedings for the judge to issue the disposition orally in court, that dependency judgments are very complex, and it is common for judges to take time with those to complete them after the court has closed session. So there are other people who have more recent experience than I do who might have a different experience, but that was my experience.
Right. Nancy, so Do you remember from that those days whether or not the general public were excluded before the judge, he or she, rendered their decision from the bench?
I've never seen someone excluded from the courtroom prior to an oral decision being made.
All right, thank you. So the questions I've put out, I know there's other, quote-unquote, certified smart people here in the room that may be with the courts or whatever. Does anyone feel like they could share a little bit or want to put something on the record? If you do, I'd like to. Tim, come on up.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Tim Lowen, the director of the Yamhill County Juvenile Department. It's been my experience and that of other juvenile department directors in the state that in almost all cases, the great majority, that the judges will render a decision in court. And I also want to make clear that presently in statute 419A 255 sub 5 and 6 has exclusions from confidentiality in juvenile delinquency cases. In sub 8, it grants the juvenile department to open up and present the allegations and petitions, the dispositions made in court of anybody who asks. It's not confidential.
Okay, thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Michael Casper. I'm from the Department of Justice, the Appellate Division, where I'm the Deputy Solicitor General. We represent DHS in litigation against the Oregonian or with the Oregonian and the mandamus proceedings that are in the Supreme Court now. I'm not here on behalf of DHS. I'm just here on behalf of the Department. I'm not here to offer any thoughts on the right policy decision, but I do want to offer the department's understanding of the current state of the law and what the Constitution requires. And our understanding, our view, is somewhat different than that of Mr. Hinkle. The view that we've taken in that litigation is that the open courts provision requires public access to live hearings. So in other words, the doors to the courtroom have to be open when a proceeding's going on, but it doesn't actually apply to documents. That's consistent with the Supreme Court's decisions to date, although I would say this, two things. One, there was a case last year, which you may have heard about, the Boy Scouts case, which involved the question of whether the public had a right of access to exhibits that were entered into evidence at a hearing, and the Supreme Court said no, it did not. The open courts provision does not apply to exhibits, but it left open the question explicitly in a footnote in that opinion whether what the analysis would be for records. So that is, in every sense of the word, a live question before the Supreme Court, or at least that has not yet been answered by the Supreme Court, and we're waiting to hear that. Our view is, as I said, that the open courts provision requires public access to hearings but doesn't actually apply to documents. Alternatively, our view is, even to the extent that it does apply to documents, it is consistent with the provision that judges have discretion to withhold documents based on their contents if the release of those documents would harm children. So the department's view is that with giving courts the discretion, which this bill would do, is consistent with the Constitution.
Okay. So just for clarification, what I'm hearing, if I'm hearing this correctly, it's not per se the order not being released. It's because an order becomes a record in the case. That's the position that we're taking as a record. It is protected or could be protected if it's not discretionarily released, as compared to the outcome that's in the in the order. It's just, we're looking as a state, it's a record, and the records are prohibited from being, or can be prohibited.
Can be prohibited, and that's key. I mean, the idea is that it's up to the discretion of the court, depending on what the contents are, which is, on the department's view, what the law has always been and what the law would continue to be under this bill.
All right.
And just as a practical matter, it orders themselves do contain often a lot of sensitive information. So,
all right, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just a slight confusion, because things that are offered in court and exhibits are protected, but records aren't records presented in court exhibits, or what's the distinction?
There's not really a distinction. I mean, from my understanding, I would say any exhibit would be part of the record, and it is.
Pardon me, Chairman Brzezinski and Senator Cruz, that the distinction, the relevant distinction, anyway, the live distinction that's kind of being sorted out in the courts is between exhibits as in evidence that was presented during the course of the hearing and the sort of what Mr. Hinkle's referred to as the judgments or the orders, the actual orders or judgments that come out of that. Those are sort of right now parts of the court file, and the question is there a different analysis as to what the open courts provision requires with respect to those? And that, as I said, is an open question, but one that's being currently litigated.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 622, Senate Bill 622? No, we're closing the public hearing on 622. And we are going to, as I mentioned, that one there, we still needed paperwork, and I think it needs some additional work on that. So I will work with counsel, and we will make inquiries and as we need to. So I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on SJR 34. And Bill, if you'll read it a little.
Chair, members of the committee, House SJR 34 comes from Senator Brzezinski, allows a judge or any court of this state to be employed by the Oregon National Guard for the purposes of performing military service or by the State Board of Education or School Board for the purposes of teaching without violating Section 1, Article 3, and Section 10, Article 2 of the Oregon Constitution.
All right, thank you. So, colleagues, except for Senator Close, I believe everyone is familiar to some level regarding the basis for SJR 34. If I'm not mistaken, I believe this is the third or fourth time that we've had this, and it just seems like it gets through the Senate, and then it gets delayed and not forward on the House for whatever reasons. But basically what this is going to allow is for our circuit court judges specifically to be able to teach in a public law school. Same thing for those who are in the National Guard or military services that are in the executive branch of government, where the judicial branch is in the judicial branch, can actually go into the public schools to actually be a teacher. They can teach at the other two law schools that we have in the state, Willamette across the street, mm-hmm. or Lewis and Clark,
right.
But they can't teach at U of O. And there are some judges that are extremely concerned that they could be in conflict with the separation of powers of the Constitution. That's all this is for, and so that's why I have brought it back again. I'm hoping at this point maybe the House will be much more reasonable to look at this based on changes of personnel in different positions.
Mr. Chair, over 2 years, my support has not changed.
All right. Thank you. So other questions, comments? And was there anyone else? There's no one that signed up on SJR 34. I was just wondering if anyone is here that wanted to give testimony or speak on that. Not seeing that, we'll close the public hearing, SJR 34. Do we have the paperwork?
Mr. Chairman, we do.
Let's right. do it.
I'll open up a work session on SJR 34.
Can I ask one question?
Yes.
If they're employed by the National Guard or by the State Board of Education, that would not be a full-time employment, would it? It would just be a part-time.
It is, and this is, I guess there was one inquiry. I mean, these individuals have full-time jobs. Mm-hmm. What they're trying to do is be what I would call an adjunct professor, someone that's coming in that has expertise in their field, and like Judge Carson Rasmussen is one of the individuals that is impacted by this. I know Judge Ann Aiken, when she was on the state bench, she would do some classes or symposiums over at the law school, and they actually have the procedural class where they actually are running students through the mock court stuff. And that's basically what it is. They're not looking to be, quote-unquote, gainfully employed. Okay. They just want to make certain the T's are crossed, the I's are dotted.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I would suggest that at both Willamette and Lewis and Clark, having that ability as enhancing the programs at the school.
I can attest to that. For my law school, it was a private school, and we had a lot of adjunct professors, and a number of them were off the bench and high-profile practitioners. I mean, for them, it wasn't. But I mean, for those that were on the bench, I mean, it's the nuts and bolts. That's what
It's having real-world experience in the classroom. That's a very positive.
Yeah, as compared to going to the Eiffel Tower and reading the books.
Yes.
All right. Any other?
Go ahead.
Okay, so this chair will take a motion on SJR 34.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR 34 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves SJR to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Close.
You said Senator Cruz. And
oh, I apologize. Was that support that you
were giving me? Back to the last time we did this,
yeah.
Right.
Senator Close. But I think we also, does this have a referral to rules?
Yes, it does.
All right. And so we...
A subsequent referral to rules.
Yeah.
I amend my motion.
All right. Thank you. So Senator Close has moved SJR 34 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, but with a subsequent referral to rules with that recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. So it's on its way to the rules.
Sure, you can take care of it there, Mr. Chair.
Well, we'll see. Been there each time.
Well, yeah.
And so we'll hopefully we'll go there. So we'll close the work session on SJR 34. And now we're going to go into our work sessions that we can work this afternoon, or this morning, excuse me. And I do understand we did get the paperwork we needed for 281.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. So let's go ahead and start at the top of the list, though, of if I have my notes correct. Senate Bill 125A is ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is not. You may remember this bill from last week. The bill relates to service members and administrative hearings and the notice under the Service Member Civil Relief Act. The bill, as we received it, had an emergency clause and had a minimal fiscal impact. There was an amendment to take off the emergency clause, and then we, committee, expressed a strong desire to set a date certain of September 1, and that's the A9 amendments that we have. We do not have the fiscal on the A9. I'm confident there is no fiscal,
right.
But nonetheless, we don't have them yet.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're in work session on SB 125A. The chair is going to move that over until next Wednesday, since that's your day.
Sure.
So that's going to SB 125A will be set for a work session again next Wednesday, which is April 17th. With that, we'll close the work session on 125A, open a work session on 188.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 188 comes to you at the request of the governor for the Department of Corrections, and we have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you. We have all the paperwork. The fiscal is minimal, allows the Oregon Youth Authority to have a release program for juvenile offenders committed to the legal custody of the Oregon Department of Corrections but placed in the Youth Authority. The Dash 1 amendments exclude from work release those who have received a mandatory minimum sentence, such as a Measure 11 sentence.
All right, so we do need the Dash 1s?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. If you want to exclude, they probably excluded anyways.
Like I said, we need the Dash 1s.
Yes. Put
exclamation mark instead of a question mark.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment into Senate Bill 188.
Senator Close moves
the
Dash 1.
Had a hybrid there for a minute, didn't
I? I have some orange juice or something. Moves the Dash 1 into Senate Bill 188. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 188 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close moves Senate Bill 188 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who would like to volunteer for 188?
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dingfelder will be the carrier on Senate Bill 188. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 188. Open a work session on Senate Bill 281.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 281 includes within the definition of deliberately medical condition post-traumatic disorder for the purposes of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have the fiscal on the bill as originally drafted.
All righty. And I know I'll want to put on the record there were some multiple amendments that had been proposed. I have looked at these amendments, and I do not believe they're necessary or appropriate. And the reason for that is that I think that once you start trying to identify where someone could potentially be impacted by a decision they make, there are other things that we're going to leave out. We did, in fact, have testimony from two veterans that talked about their benefits being in jeopardy, but they've chosen to use marijuana as a medicine because it is, has worked for them as compared to being on pharmaceuticals. And so I am very cautious and concerned that we could actually do more harm by misleading people by them not having a full menu list of what the benefits that they could potentially, or rights that they could be, let's say, losing out on if there was an adverse decision by some other governmental unit. So with that, I'd like to move SB 281 without amendments. And,
I'll move it if you want. Mr. Chair, I will move Senate Bill 281 to the floor with a due pass recommendation without amendments.
All right. Senator Dingfelder moves Senate Bill 281 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I will be opposed.
And I appreciate that. And the objections, Senator Close, based on her testimony and position, is a no. Is there anyone else?
Yes, I will be a no.
And Senator Cruz. So the other three, so motion carries. And on this one here, I'm going to see if Senator Boquist wants to.
Boquist and I were going to co-carry.
Okay. Senator Boquist and Senator Roblin will be the carriers on this bill. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 281. And that is what I have on the list. So what we're going to do is go through what we have now, and I've made one change that I want to put on the record as well. During the hearing today, I got consultation from our committee administrator, Mike Schmidt, who deals with on the criminal side of issues, and he has Tuesday. So what I'm going to do is start at the top of the list and go through what we're doing to the bills that we're moving forward but not taking action today. Senate Bill 40 is going to be scheduled for a work session on next Tuesday, April 16th. Senate Bill 125A is going to be scheduled for a work session next Wednesday, April 17th. Senate Bill 347, Senate Bill 699, Senate Bill 700, and Senate Bill 796, the ones that were the gun safety bills that we heard last Friday in public hearing. I had stated at the beginning of the session that we would carry them over till Monday. I think for more assuredness, I want to put them on Tuesday of next week, the 16th. The reason for that is that we have some amendments that are in the works. I believe that in some of the, and on one of the bills, if not two of the bills, there may be two amendments. And so I think we're going to need to have them consolidated into one amendment and get the fiscal and revenue. So I don't want to try to push these through and have people coming back and forth when we don't have them ready. So they are now going to be set for Tuesday, the 16th. The last bill that we have is Senate Bill 780. We have that set for work session on April 17th, which is next Wednesday. And Senate Bill 622, let's go ahead and put that on your day, Wednesday the 17th, because I have a feeling we're going to need an amendment on it as well. All right? So
I'm beginning to think the next week we'll be starting at 8.
And so that's the next part. A great segue.
Not on Monday.
What we're not going to start, we're going to start at 8:30 on Monday.
Great, thank you.
Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week, I want us to be posted for 8 o'clock. So we can have the full time of the committee. I appreciate y'all being willing to be flexible about our time, but this time I think it's time of the session that we need to have the potential of the full 2 hours. So if we can put on the record that Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of next week, that will be the 16th, 17th, and 18th of April. Our start time will be scheduled for 8 o'clock. If, for some reason, we determine we do not need to start that early, we'll make the adjustment because we can adjust to go later. We can't adjust to go earlier. So please make arrangements for that. The last caveat, I do not believe we're going to need to do that this session because we seem like we've been pretty orderly in getting our work done. But if for some reason we still have matters that are pending on the 17th, we may have to come back after 5 or at 5 o'clock to move some material. Now, Senator Roblin has a committee that meets until 5, and I understand we may need to carry over a little bit for that. Yeah. So if we...
I'm on a committee that meets at 3 as well, so...
Right. So if we need to do that, it will probably be like a start time at 5:30.
Yeah.
It's okay. More than likely. But I just want to give heads up so people have their schedules open if necessary. We've been able to get through this without needing to do that, but if for some reason paperwork gets hung up...
You've got to have the option.
We have the option.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else for any of the members?
Well, Mr. Chair, right. you'll probably put it on the schedule just as a caution, just to make sure it's there.
I'm going to talk to the president's office and ask that for as a fallback.
Right.
And then we will schedule that as once I get the approval.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for everyone that's here, and we'll be here tomorrow at 8:30. And we're adjourned.